and welcome to Kingdom Way Quest, episode 385. I'm your host, so old, Mike Apps, a.k.a. Wheels, and with me as always.
Feeling rather disco, David McBurney, Fanboy Master.
And, yeah, I was sick as shit last week. So much so that it delayed me posting the previous episode even longer than normal. But we're back in time for not much has happened the past 2 weeks, has it? In terms of games.
Hooray, video games.
Video games. What have you been playing?
Let's see. I finished my FF10 playthrough.
How'd that go?
So that's, by the end, I just, decided that I needed to wrap the book on it rather than let myself burn out before I rolled credits. Because I'd done a lot of grinding, and I was just I should probably make sure that I finish and come back for the rest later. And then I jumped back to do some FF9. That's a game that's very good.
Love that
game. Immaculate Vibes video game.
Yes.
And I also just popped back in Disco Elysium to try another run at that, see how differently things go this time. I am hopeful that this time I will be able to have my Thai talk. I think if you pass, an Inland Empire check early enough in the game, your Thai just starts talking to you in your head. The game sort of implies to, when it vocalizes in-game, allegedly it basically is just implied to be your protagonist just sort of making a weird voice. Good video game. Important video game. But yeah, that's why my intro was feeling very disco.
Nice. Farmer says, morning, still haven't done with Graces yet, and I'm about to wrap it up. I am.
There's a lot of Graces.
Some slower on these matters.
Yeah.
Distracted.
Noted easily distracted man wheel.
Including, I got a new XSEED game, Cuisineer. I'm never going to be able to pronounce this game correctly.
How is it spelled?
Cuisineer.
Yeah, Cuisineer.
Cuisineer. As a distraction, because it's roguelike dungeons and managing a restaurant mixed together.
That's a nightmare.
It's quite fun in smaller
games. Yeah, I'm just allergic to roguelikes.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm enjoying it quite a bit, but still making my way through Graces, and I'm probably going to start Yakuza Kiwami on the Switch soon as well.
Yeah, honk honk.
For some punchies.
I think one of the things I want to do is run back and finish off Metaphor. I think I was halfway through that.
Nice.
And then I want to finally do Like a Dragon Infinite Wealth. I feel like those would suit me well.
Yes. Need to get to that as well. Need to finish some Yakuza this year.
Yeah, no. Kiwami's real good. I would suspect that a deluge of Yakuza ports will find their way to the Switch 2 over time.
I would imagine so. And probably Metaphor, which is why I'm kind of wondering if I should just distract myself with other things until that April presentation, and then See if it's announced there, because if it is, then I'm not going to play it on PlayStation. It's not going to happen. I should just accept that and move on. But yeah, I can keep playing, continuing to play Graces. I'm going to just play that till I finish it, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. I need to boot into Graces, but I had Disco on the brain, so...
That's fair. When you get a game on the brain like that, sometimes you just have to put other things aside.
Yeah, like, you're not going to get any focus on the thing that, by trying any, on something else by trying to force it.
Yeah. I've also been playing Final Fantasy VII Rebirth.
Hell yes.
I'm having grand old fucking time.
It's such a fun game.
Yes, it is.
I'm glad that the PC version's doing well.
Yeah.
Seems to be the best launch that the series has had on the platform, which is good to see. Like, for a single-player game that had released a year ago, 40,000 concurrent players is not too bad.
Not at all.
Jeez. But
filling up the chat.
Yeah, and they like, by all accounts, they really did yeoman's work getting that to run on the deck. There's some interesting interviews with Hamaguchi where he started talking about, like, how much time they spent tweaking it to try to make sure that it would run acceptably as far as they were concerned. So I'm looking forward to, like, I'm deliberately holding back on starting it on deck because, like I said, I want to get done with some of the other deck games that I've had by the wayside. But, you know, I respect that. And it's also one of those things where it's like, him talking about, like, we want to optimize to get this on as many platforms as possible. It's like, I'll bet you do.
Sure you do. What other platform might you be talking about?
Yeah, I would suspect that, like, Part 3 is going to launch on, like, 5 platforms at once.
I'm sure.
Like, it's, like, at this point, I think that fully exclusivity, no matter how much money was put behind it, it would not be worth, like, the damage to the brand that exclusivity is doing, so. That's going to be on everything. But, yeah. So, yeah. Like, where are you in Rebirth? I'm curious.
Cosmo Canyon.
Oh, hell yeah. Have you actually gotten into Cosmo Canyon yet?
Yeah.
Like, the town itself?
Yeah. Currently doing a trial with Red 13 and Barrett.
Yeah, minor spoilers for those who haven't gotten around to it yet, so maybe skip ahead a minute or so, but I think one of the single funniest things in the game is the betrayal in Barrett's voice when he realizes that Red 13 has been putting on a voice to sound older. Like, the two have clearly spent a while, and, like, Barrett is like, oh, he's the other old guy in the party, the other mature adult here, and then it's like, oh, you're just another fucking kid.
No.
Yeah, that's a great bit. That section has some great expansions on the lore from the original FF7, like, where it takes, like, the Gi that were in this area in the original, and it kind of expands on who they are and their relation to everything. So it's a really cool area. I really like that part of the game, which is good because I was already predisposed to love Cosmo Canyon as an environment. There's a side quest in that area where you, where Tifa and Barrett spend time reminiscing about the old Avalanche crew. That's a really good bit because it's like, the specific relationship between those two characters and how and what that dynamic looked like when you know, during the Avalanche days that we don't really see a lot of in the you know, in the games, just because, you know, the game starts when Cloud gets there and then kind of everything goes to pot. But Yeah, like it's just another one of those things that's just like great about Rebirth is that it just has all these
good times.
But yeah, just but yeah, like
Oh, that reminds me. It's also the winner of our RP Gamer RPG of the Year award.
yes. It was like I would not have been unhappy if like because the other front runner was obviously Metaphor and there
Yeah.
was no wrong answer, but I was happy to see Rebirth bring home the gold.
Yep. It's fun. I wonder how much that had to do with more people actually finishing Rebirth, given its release earlier in the year, but I haven't actually looked at any of the numbers or anything, so I'm not sure.
Yeah. Exactly. Did Metaphor come out again?
It's November, wasn't
Would have
it?
been early September, I think. Something there. No. Okay. This was October.
Okay.
Okay, so there were a few months to get to it, but yeah, there's probably fewer people that had time to finish it. It's a toss-up sort of thing, but
But regardless, they were both deserving, and third place was Unicorn Overlord,
yeah,
which also
also well
won
deserved.
Surprise of the Year. I know because I wrote that section of the awards. Because I was surprised. Like, not that the game was good. Like,
It just wasn't on the radar of what to be looking for or
right,
expecting.
because, we all kind of like Vanillaware, but it's not like any of their games are like have ever been like the best. They're just
I
really
mean,
pretty kind of
people really
mid.
stumped for 13 Sentinels.
I forget. I always forget about that one. Yeah, that one got a lot of love, and maybe had I gotten to it,
At any point.
I at any point I would have been less surprised by this, but yeah. But regardless, it's well deserved. Another very good game. Lots of very good RPGs last year.
Yeah, it was a big year for RPGs.
Like Romancing Saga and there's lots of other stuff too. Stuff I haven't even gotten to, so. That is sweet. Did we miss any big news last week? Can't think
If
of
we did,
anything.
my brain is too fucking cooked
Yeah.
to remember it.
My brain is going to be cooked on Monster Hunter in a few weeks.
Oh yeah, we got like there's news I care about
Oh, that's right. There was
that.
news in that Monster Hunter thing just for you.
That's for me. Onimusha 2 is back, baby.
Yeah.
I assumed that they would not bother, but I guess in the lead up to Onimusha 5, which they also talked a bit more about, didn't show a lot more of, but they talked a bit more about it. They're remastering Onimusha 2, which, like, 2 and 3 kind of in a dead heat for what's the best of that franchise, as far as I'm concerned. They do different things very well. But 2 had this interesting sort of branching story concept where you had like 5 ally characters, and depending upon how you treated them, like, it would affect like big swaths of where you went and what you did. It's still a mostly linear game, but there's a lot of like little variations depending upon who your ally characters are. Onimusha games have always been kind of dicey to re-release, because Onimusha, the previous Onimusha games, like 1 through 3, and I think 4 might, but 4 is just dog shit, so I don't care to look it up. But 1 through 3 all have... Yeah, Dawn of Dreams, it's real bad. I believe its protagonist appeared in 1 Capcom versus game, Tatsunoko versus Capcom, and then was consigned to the dustbin of history. No one remembers Soki. But, so 1 through 3, at the very least, all have likeness rights issues. Samunosuke from Onimusha's 1 and 3 is designed to look like actor Takeshi Kaneshiro. And 3 also has French actor Jean Renault in likeness rights. And 2 has deceased actor, I think it's Isaku Matsuda. Let me double check if I'm remembering that correctly. Yeah, Isaku Matsuda. Americans of a certain age would probably remember him from the old movie Black Rain. But he died in the late 80s. But Capcom licensed his likeness for protagonist Jubei Yagyu. That basically means that if they ever want to re-release any of these, they have to re-clear the likeness rights. So that's why these have always been kind of a weird, dicey proposition to ever see come back. So it's telling that they seem to want to revive Onimusha as a brand, that they're willing to go back and re-clear these rights. And I'm glad. I think that Onimusha 2 is a great game. Holds up well. It's a really neat thing. The way that they've talked about Onimusha 5, I definitely think that there will be Souls influence in that, but I don't think it'll just be Capcom trying to do Souls, just based on some of the things that they've said. Like, one of the things that they went out of their way to say in the presentation during the Capcom spotlight was, like, we are not trying to make an incredibly difficult game. We just want to make a really cool sword fighting game.
Sweet.
So, yeah, I'm interested. But yeah, like, I'm willing to... I mean, Capcom, especially over the past, like, 8 to 10 years, has been very good about making sure that when they take a swing, they don't miss. So I'm willing to just see where they're going with Onimusha 5. If you've never played an Onimusha game, the remaster of the first one, it's a slight game, a pretty short game, but it's pretty fun. If you know the old Onimusha,
one I have played is the first one.
Yeah, definitely 2 is a much stronger game, a much more confident game. Definitely the one that I would recommend, that if you just want to try one of the old ones, that's the one to try. What's the other thing I was going to say about it? Onimusha. Nope, it's gone. But yeah, what I was going to say was, there's also some really obscure Onimusha games that I don't think anyone remembers happening, other than like me and 12 other people.
The GBA one?
Yeah, that's Onimusha Tactics. That's one of them. The other one that, like, always lives in my head forever is Onimusha Blade Warriors, which is a Smash clone.
What the fuck? They made a Smash clone?
Yes. It's a really strange thing to exist. I don't know how it happened. It's weird. It's real weird. After Onimusha 3, I believe a number of the people involved with it ended up being transitioned onto Shadow of Rome, a weird Colosseum theme, like Roman Colosseum era themed action game that I believe was made under the basis that the assumption was the thing holding back Onimusha in the Western market was that it was too Japanese. That's the only way I can assume why it happened. Not a bad game. I know a number of that team then ended up going on to Dead Rising, but just a whole weird mess. But yeah, there was a period of about 4 or 5 years where Capcom really tried to make Onimusha a thing, and it did well. Like, it would be a lie to say that Onimusha was not popular in its day, but it was not as popular as Resident Evil. It was not as popular as Devil May Cry. In general, it was seen as like a game that certainly did well enough to keep going, but that it was never quite as popular as they thought it should be. But yeah, still a big fan of it. I think it's got a lot that's really charms me about it. Especially those old ones have a very PS2 era feel to them that I am a known advocate for. So, you know, some grain of salt for what I think, but yeah, it's nice to see that come back. They talked a bit more about the Okami sequel, seemingly just trying to be clear that yes, that is happening. That is there will be an Okami sequel. You will not be able to stop us. Yeah, it looks like Fire Miner has a bunch of questions. Since remasters are in vogue again, let me ask this. You previously talked about how bad translation and bad dubbing became integral to the games, but what about bugs? And I'm not talking about innocent ones like the Juggernaut bug. That's not even an innocent one. That's the reason that people were pissed enough that they patched that back in as an option was that it was the only way that Juggernaut was even usable. Talking about the Sims Legacy Collection being just as buggy as the original release, even after EA has fixed some bugs. I mean, this is not a preservation effort as far as they're concerned. It's just a thing that they do to squeeze money out of something, so I'm not surprised. But yeah, like, there's always going to be arguments about bugs. In general, I'd be like, I'm generally partial to taking a light touch to these sorts of things and saying, like, unless it's something that threatens to just fuck over the average player, it's probably fine. But, like, also you run into the issue of, like, in the porting process, some bugs are just going to go away, like, because of the difference in how the game functions now, and spending a lot of time recreating them can be a problem too. There's just all sorts of technical things that happen. Oh yeah, I would be remiss if we didn't talk about this. They announced their release date for Metal Gear Solid Delta.
Yay.
I don't care. I know some people do. That's out in August, apparently. It seems to have leaked earlier than it's supposed to, so I guess grain of salt, but I would believe that. The other thing is that they showed that the Snake versus Ape mode from the original is back. It was at the time it was a tie-in to Ape Escape 3, and it of course never reappeared because it was multi-platform now, and that was a Sony franchise, and also it was the game it was advertising was no longer relevant, so it was gone. It's back now. The ape models just look like absolute unvarnished dog shit. I briefly just complained about this on Blue Sky. There's a difference between something that looks charmingly out of, charmingly off the aesthetic, like a charming aesthetic clash, and whatever is happening there. This just sort of looks like it was hard to make the apes look good in the engine, because like in the original, the apes are very clearly like aesthetically off. They do not look like realistic animals. Everything else in the game looks mostly like a realistic animal. But like there's a certain sense that the art team knew how to bridge that gap and make it funny. And in this case, it just sort of looks like the art team was told these have to be in here. And they, like, the time was not there or the passion was not there. I'm going to assume the time was not there to make them look good in the... Because, like, one of the things I've noticed whenever I look at Delta is that the art direction they're pursuing is much less stylized than the original. So it's much harder to bring off this aesthetic clash in a way that looks fun instead of just weird. And the ape models just sort of look really cheap. Like, it very much looks like this was a directive thrust upon them without a lot of extra time or budget thrown into it. It's, and that's kind of a shame, just because, like, the charm of Snake versus Ape is that it's weird and incongruous. The actual gameplay of it is kind of dog shit. It's, like, you know, you shoot them with the monkey gun and then you run up and touch them and it's just kind of tag, but bad. It is not the fun part of the game. It's just, you know, funny because it's contextually insane. And so the failure to make the aesthetic whimsical, to make this feel whimsical, really, really does hurt it. It does leave me wondering if they're going to try to recreate the Guy Savage demo. For those unaware, if you save and quit at a very specific point in the game, when Snake is locked in a cell, there is a random chance that when you load the game, instead of loading directly back into the game, you will load into a nightmare he's having of a guy fighting vampires with like a sword cane or whatever. This was allegedly some sort of pitch demo for a game that never got picked up, and it never reappeared in any of the previous in any of the re-releases, because like recreating the pitch demo that was cut is a huge pain in the ass, and like I'm sure most of that source code is just fucking gone. So, those PS2 copies are the only versions that ever had it. If they're recreating Snake versus Monkey, it's possible they'll try to recreate Guy Savage. So that gives it some mild interest. Personally, I still feel like the art direction is just not what I want. Like, for as much as people remember Metal Gear Solid as being extremely realistic looking, it was realistic looking at a time when realistic looking could only be so realistic looking. And the quirks of the era were forced them to have like some degree of stylization. Like, and bearing in mind that like there was a desire to I think that these games were supposed to look stylized in a way that we didn't at the time really appreciate, because you look at, like, if you ever compare the art direction from Metal Gear Solid 2 and 3 to Metal Gear Solid the Twin Snakes, you see very different interpretations on fundamentally very similar looking, what you would think would be fundamentally very similar looking games. But like MGS 2 and 3's art direction holds up much, much better than Twin Snakes. Something about the modeling, the shading, like texturing, it all adds up to being like MGS 2 and 3 just has just enough stylization that it doesn't feel bad to look at. And I Delta looks like a Twin Snakes to me. But that's to each their own. I know some who oppose director's cuts because they think the movies, after they've been released in cinemas, become not the author's property anymore, but the audience's. Shouldn't game remasters, not remakes, be seen under the same light? In general, like, I've, I think I, in particular, I, Wheels perhaps to a slightly lesser extent, but, you know, I've generally been of the opinion that, like, a remaster should first and foremost be trying to recreate the original game as best as possible. Like, everything else is kind of secondary when you're looking at a remaster. Like, you should be pursuing the original. I mean, like, it's, I disagree with the notion that it's, that there's some sense of ownership that has passed just by dint of the fact that that original game is still there. You know, as long as you're keeping it in circulation. I do generally think that, like, the desire to do, oh, we're remastering it, but for this one little thing, is generally kind of misguided. There should, at the very, I'm generally of the opinion there should be an option to play as unretouched a version as you can manage. And I know that there will always be technical issues with that and always disagreements about what that even looks like. But in general, I think that should be, like, you know, if you have options to make alterations or add content, that's fine. But the first thing should be to recreate the original experience, because that is, like, you know, the remastering team is often, the team that makes a remaster is an interpreter of the work. And, you know, in that same sense of, like, this would be less a, like, since so many remasters end up being made by an unrelated team, these end up being, like, a studio's alternate cut, rather than even having the mark of being a director's cut, for whatever that, for whatever that's worth. And, you know, that doesn't mean that that their ideas are bad, but it does mean that their ideas are essentially the idea, like until proven otherwise, they end up being of similar value to anyone's takeaway. But they ultimately drag the work to the ideas of a third party. And that, you know, I just think it's useful to have, like, just as close to an original version as you can manage. Isn't it nice that games like The Sims 2 were made on duct tape and prayers, and yet so many things were built on top of it? Is this an argument against expansions, that unless your coding is good and optimized, putting more stuff upon it will just lead to disaster? Then again, that option is out of the hands of the programmers and lays with the executives. There's also just the fact that, like, basically, at some point in its development process, some part of your game is going to be held together by duct tape. Like, it will always end up being that there's something that you couldn't engineer to be ideal. Is it an argument against expansions? It makes making expansions harder, just because you're, like, it creates an inherent amount of tech debt that comes with making an expansion. But it's, there's really only so much you can do. Like, if you want to build on the existing code, you're gonna just have to live with it. And if you want to make games faster, which at this point everyone should, like, not in the sense of, like, you know, bam 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 churn them out, but in the sense of, like, you know, video games should not, it is not healthy for the industry that a normal sequel takes 5 years. Like, that's just bad for everyone. You're going to have to just build on what's already there. You're going to have to accept the tech debt and just build on what you already have. that is something that, and you know, expansion packs represent accepting that aspect of game design. It's just, this is here and we have to live with it, and we just worry about re-engineering it the next time we have to build from scratch. But there is always going to be stuff. Like, video games are smoke and mirrors. Like, we want to imagine an infinite world behind the curtain, but if you pull the curtain aside, you will eventually reach the point where it's just like, nothing's rendered here, there's nothing here. And that the same is true of the systems that underlie them. Like, you will just find stuff that is not ideally coded, because maybe it was a feature request that was almost cut or even briefly was rescoped out of the game. Maybe it was a feature that was just a pet project of some particular portion of the dev team. There's all sorts of reasons that can happen. Or maybe it was just a feature that seemed like it would be easier to implement than it was. They couldn't cut it because it was part of the milestones, so they kept it, but they kind of had to just make the minimum version of it. Like, there's all sorts of reasons that things just end up being like, well, here's the simplest version we can manage of it, or here is the, like, we made the version that we could make. That's just the process. Devil May Cry 2 and Code Veronica are flawed games, and there are visible games to be made if they ever got remade. But
Moncappy in RP Gamer Chat is yelling at me because I didn't update the game, so it still says Tales of Graces F. I apologize.
Can't believe you're not taking the chance to call this Tales of Destiny 2.
Oh my god. I will, assuming you're going to keep watching the stream, once we end the recording, I will play more Tales of Graces F. But it's easier to play this than a game that requires me to read or listen to dialogue while trying to focus on doing a podcast.
Can't read or write. Okay. Don't make Cartoon, Code Veronica, or Flood Games. Physical games to be made if they ever got remade, but how will you remake a game like Onimusha 3 with Flaw? It's both more subtle and fundamental that it makes the game less fun than its predecessor. You can just copy and paste Onimusha 2's combat system into 3. No, not really. Like, you would break a whole bunch of other things in the process. But, I mean, I personally like Onimusha 3. I don't have any particular reason that I would want it to have some sort of ground up changes to it. But it's been many years, who can say? But yeah, I would say my attitude remains the same for anything that would actually be a full on remake, which is, well, if you're going to make a full on remake, you should make it different as hell. Let's see. Leo Grimm has been playing Onimusha Tactics on the RP Gamer stream. I just finished. Recommended him to play Shining Force GBA, a Resurrection of the Dark Dragon.
Yeah, it's a nice version of that game.
Yeah, that's a really strange little remake, just because it's like a GBA port of Shining Force would not have been difficult. And that remake does not change that much, as I recall.
No, it really doesn't.
It's one of those like remakes that to me will always be like, this is just a confusing use of resources. But Sega, when are you porting Shining Force 3 to anything? Let's see. Speaking of the audience's ownership of a work of art, has there been any game that was misread by the fans and/or hijacked by an ideological movement? I mean, I don't know how much it's a misread, but there are definitely games that, like, people sort of take up as a symbol that, in cases where they don't seem to actually like them that much. But I also don't want to talk too much about that just because it's really fucking depressing. But there are definitely things where, like, the enthusiasm that exists seems to exist less for the object of art and more for, like, the theoretical symbol of the object of art, which is a little sad for a lot of different reasons. I'm not sure how many of those were actual misreadings of the original intent either. Okay, so now people are looking at them like Chronicles Cross, definitive editions, file size being dramatically reduced, and then demand that more games should be optimized. But is it because Monolith is staffed by Wizards, or because UE5, which has become more popular with remakes, is still very unoptimized? I think it's more just that, like, it's generally on, like, PC and like other consoles, with generally the expectation that the player has a larger amount of space, and or that the physical the cost of physically manufacturing higher capacity cards is just generally cheaper, there's just less incentive to do it. You know, you've got a team that's got a few months left to release a game, and you know, Nintendo being the company that they are, with the amount of teams that they have and the kind of rolling release schedules that they've had for the past few years, where they've had games finished far enough in advance that, like, I will never forget the point where, like, Xenoblade 3 and Splatoon 3 just swapped release orders barely last minute, just because it meant that, like, because Xenoblade 3 was basically done and Splatoon 3 needed a little more time. So, you know, a company that has their release schedules planned out at a in such a way that, like, the release schedule isn't as soon as it's done, if not sooner, has a bit more time to just have developers sit there trying to, you know, make the file size a little easier to deal with, and similarly has financial incentives to make the game have a smaller footprint for a number of reasons. So I think between those two things, Xenoblade is just kind of in a unique space. I'm sure that it's possible to file size to manage smaller file sizes. I think some of this might also be trailing consumer demand, so to speak, where by which I mean, like, for a while it was almost a selling point, like, this game is huge, there must be so much stuff in it. And, like, it, you know, it reminds you of the PS1 era, if you were around for that, where, like, you know, oh, look at this enormous RPG on multiple discs. Like, you know, Final Fantasy VII is on 3 discs. Final Fantasy VIII is on 4 discs. Like, it gave the illusion of value. So there was, like, a mild marketing incentive to not try to keep those, you know, a mild marketing incentive that came with, like, the cost of manufacture increases a bit, but the marketing is more able to say, like, look at how much there is here. And nowadays, with so many games being, like, you know, with the majority of the, you know, like, most PS5 games are on, like, an at most, like, quad layer Blu-ray disc that can have, like, 100 gigs. Like, you know, very few PS5 games are going to be on more than one disc. So there's not even, like, a huge manufacturing switch. Like, multi-layer discs are, I believe, very slightly in terms of manufacturing, but, like, it's not exactly going to break the bank any which way you look at it. So for a while, I think it was considered that, like, a larger file size gave the illusion of more value. And, like, we're reaching the point where it's clear that, like, at least the hardcore consumers are getting, like, just pissed off at, because they're constantly having to download these enormous games with these enormous patches. I don't know if that'll be enough to make doing like a file size optimization pass, something that companies spend their time doing. But we're seeing companies like try to find creative ways around it. I think a lot about how Street Fighter VI is designed so that you can, the installation is modular. You can still play like versus with your friends, even if you delete World Tour mode. I think we might see companies try to get more creative about that, just to try to sort of deal with the demands that these have created. Yeah, have you guys done a benchmark to see if your PC can run Monster Hunter Wilds? I'm not terribly interested in running it, so I have not.
No, I'm playing it on PS5.
Also, hello, Joe.
Hello.
It's a Joe. The Wild Joe approaches, Command.
Japroaches.
Japroaches.
Japroach. What? Now you're getting ridiculous. Yeah, but you bought nice new computer that could totally run MH Wilds.
Yeah, but PlayStation okay. Portal.
Yeah, okay.
You play Monster Hunter.
I hope that you're not running into any lag with that, because that feels like it would be a killer on Monster Hunter.
No, I got a good enough connection.
Yeah.
Fiber.
Need very precise inputs on that game. Yeah.
But, yeah. I mean, if it has cross-save, I'll end up with a PC copy as well.
But I will end up with five copies.
Yeah. But it's Monster Hunter. I got to buy my physical copy anyway, so I'm not going to play it on PC first. Especially with the fact that it's cross-play.
Okay.
So PlayStation it is.
Oh, yeah, because it's not coming to Xbox, right?
No, it is.
Oh, okay.
It is. I think I prefer...
If you're not sure about crossplay, the PlayStation's probably a safer bet.
Yeah.
I do know that they did announce crossplay at some point, though.
Yeah. That's what the beta that starts tonight is going to be. Going to have crossplay as well. But yeah, I've kind of switched. I used to buy everything on Xbox, and now I've kind of reversed course.
Me too.
But yeah, it's mostly still shooty things on Xbox, but yeah. I like PlayStation Portal because I like playing
PlayStation Portable.
The PlayStation Portal.
The PlayStation Portable?
No, stop.
No.
Get your PSP with your UMD copy of Spider-Man 2?
Oh my god. Yeah, that's been like a revelation, because it's like, wow, I can play games portably much nicer than I can on the Steam Deck. So,
UMD copy of the hit romantic comedy Hitch.
Oh, why would that fucking movie? Why?
Why? It was one of those like UMD movies that I just saw every time there was a UMD movie section in a store, and I was like, here's a copy of Hitch.
Sure, because it's not a very good movie.
Yeah, but Will Smith is charming, so it kind of carries it.
No, he's a great guy as long as you keep his wife's name out of your mouth.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Fireminer has referenced Food for Dogs, which, yes, is an excellent channel.
I'll have to look at that one. I have not looked.
A sweet old lady who plays JRPGs, and she's great.
Oh my god. This the Destiny username of this guy that just joined my post. Trafalgar D. Law.
That's quite a name.
It's a One Piece character.
No, I could tell.
Okay. Was it the D?
It was the everything.
Yeah.
Gee, serious question. Why haven't we gotten a Persona starring retirees? I mean, we don't get a lot of games with Star World people.
No.
You know how the older someone gets, the more childish they become. Retirees also have the time and space to meet people different from them, and they are restrained by ambition and career like college students or salarymen are. Yeah, it's just the other thing that you run into is like if we just take this and divorce it from all marketing questions, which are complex and many layered, you run into one of the things that makes a high school protagonist easy in a game like Persona is that there's a sort of inherent to many ages, there is an inherent draw to the notion of like a high schooler is someone who is both becoming an adult but trying to like learn their place in the world and prove themselves as a person in a way that like is easy to relate to even when you've passed that age. The struggles of like someone looking at the world from the point where you're aware that you're much closer to your end than your beginning are both harder for a younger audience to relate to and also kind of depressing in a way that like it becomes less clear what kinds of goals to give an older protagonist. Like you end up having to go deeper into something very specific. It's obviously not impossible, but like, you know, you're introducing a number of additional balancing acts to try to make that appeal to a younger audience, which will always be a significant part of that. I also think that the game market is underserving retirees. I think that there's definitely an argument for that. Like, you know, if we just look at like games as a whole, that there's definitely like older people end up having like the kind of time to actually spend on these things, but you know, the demands and designs of the of games as a whole tend to push hard for what, you know, what the assumptions are about what youthful players want. I will say that like before she passed, my mom enjoyed like, you know, mobile puzzle games, and I think that like to some extent that market, like mobile games that are, you know, not of the like pure gacha variety, but of like the more, you know, like puzzles and, you know, things like Wordle derivatives, like certainly younger people play those, but like, you know, an older person would be able to enjoy those without having to learn like a bunch of complicated rule sets. Like, you bring up the notion of like kids who grew up with like Pac-Man and the Atari reaching retirement age, but you know, a lot of those people did not necessarily keep up with games, and so complicated like console games might not be the place to try to sell to them at the moment. You know, you give it another 10 or so years, you'll probably start we'll start seeing this more and more as a thing, but I think right now honestly the place to go is those like simpler mobile experiences, because they capture people who maybe they played games when they were relatively young, maybe they didn't, but you know, you get these sort of experiences that you know, people remember from you get those sorts of more universal experiences. As for story-based games, I'm sure there's, again, I'm sure there's a lot of room for that, but it's hard, you're dealing with a lot of additional concerns. I've asked several times about the disdain certain people have towards visual novels, but I also notice a certain strain of gamers of people who see an Atlas RPG and then immediately demand it to have romance. Then you look at life simulators at Rune Factory and The Sims and etc., and romance has always been one of the focal points to the fans. Begs the question, what if someone right now put a lot of budget into a game like Thousand Arms? How much profit can they expect? So the thing is that, like, the commonality of theme that I notice among games that have, like, romance as a huge part of their fan base is that you don't usually see games that front and center the romance do this. It's just that when people get invested in them, that's one of the things they get invested in. And honestly, that might be one of the reasons that they become a huge fan rather than just a casual one. But I do think that there's still enough of this stigma around it that you kind of have to Trojan horse it. I'm going to steal a line from a YouTube video where someone was talking about Tokimeki Memorial, where they were talking about how, like, gamers, English-speaking gamers usually need to have romance, like, Trojan horse to them, like, putting a putting medicine in a treat for a dog.
Wow.
Like, there is just this certain, like, stigma around it that has never entirely faded, this idea of, like, you know, the idea of simulating romance as the primary activity rather than something you do in addition to everything else as being, like, solely the domain of weird losers. And it's hard to make, like, someone would have to make a concerted effort. Also, you'd probably want to write better than Thousand Arms, because man, I remember playing the opening of that game, and it made me uncomfortable how many of the opening dialogues are you, like, talking to the maids in your house, and all of them responding by making it clear that they would really like it if they could continue talking without you groping them in the middle of the conversation.
Oh.
Jeez.
I think it lightens up on that as time goes by, but that was a hell of a first impression to make.
Well, I enjoyed Honey Pop. You know?
That's, yeah, but that one's also, like, explicitly pornography.
Yeah. Honey Pop. It's a neat little match 3 puzzle game until you get to the naughty bits.
What?
No.
Do I want to know?
I don't know. Well, we were talking about puzzle games that older gamers might like, and then you're talking about visual novels, and
I see where you got there.
I see.
You see how I got there? And no, it's a neat game, you know. You got good reviews when you discount all that stuff.
It's a pornography store. I was buying pornography. Don't tell me we're at a bar. But what else is open at that time of night? Kinnikuman started out as an Ultraman parody before becoming a wrestling series. JoJo started out trying to fell Fist of the North Star before doing its own thing. Yu-Gi-Oh! At the beginning, it wasn't about a card game. Is there any game franchise that started out as one thing but found success with a much different thing?
No. Hold up. Rewind for a second. Yu-Gi-Oh! Didn't start off about a card game?
No. The original story was, like, it was a sort of semi-horror manga styling where Yugi would play, like, Yugi would get possessed by his alter ego and play a game of improvised rules every time, and then, like, after winning would inflict, like, nightmarish punishments on whoever had crossed him.
Huh.
It's a lot. Eventually, the card game comes in, and originally, it is called Magic and Wizards. Because it is just... it has very few defined rules, because it's just a device for that week's issue. And it is named entirely on the basis of Kazuki Takahashi just really liking Magic the Gathering. So it is named for Magic the Gathering and Wizards of the Coast. Eventually, so, like, I remember variously seeing issues of. There was an early issue I remember reading where, like, an escaped prisoner takes one of Yugi's friends hostage with a gun. And so, and demands, like, a bottle of tequila and a getaway driver or something. And basically, Yugi challenges him to a game where they are each allowed to use one finger. And who, like, he's allowed to, if the prisoner wants to shoot his gun, he can do that. But basically, whoever survives is the winner. And what ends up happening there is the prisoner had, in addition to a, like, high-proof alcohol, had also demanded a cigarette. Yugi keeps his chooses his thumb, lights a lighter under the guise of just lighting the prisoner's cigarette. And then, as the prisoner is pouring his extremely high-proof alcohol, just leaves the lighter on his hand that is pouring, thus causing so that if he were to fire the gun, the alcohol, which is now streaming past the bounds of his cup and onto his person, is going to light him on fire. Huh. While he's deciding what to do with that situation, ultimately he accidentally lights himself on fire anyway. That's how a lot of these things go. At least one of these, and a bunch of these end with someone probably dying. Some of them just end with them being permanently disfigured. It's a weird manga for a very long time. And even after it becomes about the card games, like, Kazuki Takahashi eventually just, like, finds excuses to drag it back to being about whatever game he feels like. So, like, the last arc of the manga version of Yu-Gi-Oh! Is a big old tabletop game. He was a guy that just liked games, like... and liked weird horror shit, and the intersection of that was this.
Okay.
But yeah. R.I.P. Kazuki Takahashi. Let's see.
And why would you like to become a big brother? Don't say revenge. Don't say revenge.
Don't say revenge.
Revenge.
Revenge. Just mark that down. Okay, but yeah. Does anyone still play Fortnite Save the World? I'm sure, like, some amount, but certainly not a meaningful number. I think a lot about... we can get some, like... Some edge cases. There is not, for example, a second fighting game Dynasty Warriors, even though the original was. To some greater or lesser extent, we could also include situations where, like, a spinoff overshadowed its original. In Japan, Momotaro Densetsu is much less popular than Momotaro Dentetsu. Momotaro Densetsu is a RPG type construction based off of the old the ancient folktale of the Peach Boy Momotaro, and Momotaro Dentetsu is a spinoff of that that is based on the pun of, instead of saying like legend like Dentetsu, you make a very slight alteration to pronunciation and get Momotaro's electric train. That's one of the ones I would think of, like, oh, the The spin-off about the spin-off board game simulation seems like it has much more of a lasting footprint. I think there's at least twice as many Momotaro Dentetsu games than there are Densetsu games. Let's see. It looks like there's at least 23 Momotaro Dentetsu games. And there's like six Momotaro Densetsu games. Like, it's, and yeah, that version sort of dies out in like 2000. And that's being very generous in terms of how you're counting, but Momotaro Dentetsu continues to this day. Once again, I would bring up Dynasty Warriors, which in Japan was technically considered a spinoff, but you know, like, again, like, we would, as far as like in general, there was never another attempt to make a Dynasty Warriors fighting game of any meaningful sense. They just, like, the Shin San Goku Musou just completely took over, and there was never any attempt to bother making a fighting game again. Kind of the reverse of this. The allegedly Arc System Works did not set out to make a fighting game with Guilty Gear, and repeatedly kept trying to make things that weren't fighting games, and just sort of fell back into making fighting games. Like, if you look at interviews from around Guilty Gear, The Missing Link, there's like, yeah, the next one probably won't be another fighting game. And then, like, there's one non-fighting game Guilty Gear of any note, that's Guilty Gear 2. And that's a thing they never went back to. They just went back to making fighting games. But kind of a reverse situation where, like, the developer, similarly, I would bring up the reverse of this being id Software kept trying to make things that were not first-person shooters, and kept not happening. Quake was originally supposed to be some sort of like sprawling action RPG that just somehow turned into Quake. Like, things turned into first-person shooters because that was just sort of what they knew how to make. Okay, I've been playing Tony Hawk games on my iMac G4. The ports are pretty good, but man, Pro Skater 4 doesn't feel great like its predecessors. How much do you think it comes down to the mission system dragging down the stage design and other aspects of the games? I couldn't even agree with you on that. I've played all four of the Prime Pro Skater games within the past year. I like Pro Skater 4 a lot.
Yeah, I prefer the GameCube version.
It's probably a little nicer, but
and I did try to tune into your Tony Hawk 2 stream,
mm-hmm.
but it was hurting my eyes and my brain, and then warpy. I had other things I wanted to do as well. But I'm like, why isn't he just playing the remaster? Why?
Because I care about the originals.
That's fine.
How did I miss the stream?
It happens on Tuesdays. You're never there for the Tuesday streams.
Yeah, those are usually too early for me to tune in.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. No worries, man.
Yeah, Beat was promoting you on Blue Sky.
Yeah, that's what he does. But yeah,
I wasn't gonna jump in either because I heard voices I didn't recognize, and
yeah, there's like six or so people in there.
Yeah, so. I was like, I got other things that I gotta do anyways.
Hmm.
And I wasn't invited, so.
If you wanted in, you'd be allowed in.
Yeah, I know. I know.
But let's see. But yeah, I like the Pro Skater 4 levels. I'm sure that, like, I'll probably dig into that on those streams when I get to Pro Skater 4. I believe next week. This is a sneak preview for those paying attention. I will actually not be playing Tony Hawk's Pro Skater. I will be playing one of its better knockoffs from the era, Grind Session.
There was a good knockoff?
Its developer was then contracted to make the PlayStation 1 version of Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 3.
You're not going to play Skate?
That would be a pain in the ass to emulate. And also, I'm doing these in order.
Okay.
grind session is from like 2000, right around the same time as Tony Hawk 2.
Play the Tony Hawk that had the My Name is Earl guy.
That is Project 8. That's one of the bad ones.
Oh, okay.
It's a bit of a shame. Like, they just don't feel very precise on the PS3 to me. I do think Proving Ground is kind of underrated.
I had some fun with Underground 2 and a little bit of fun with American Wasteland.
American Wasteland is the one where it feels like there's just too many features.
Yeah. Yeah, I can agree with that.
But yeah, I like Underground 2. Like, at the time it was a little bit cringeworthy, but now it's like, oh, this is a time capsule of what people thought was cool in 2004.
Yeah, like Margera.
There's Bam Margera, there's a lot of Jackass. I might, like, if you've never played it, the PSP version of that, also made by Java Games, who made Grind Session and the PS1 version of THPS3, has a baffling amount of content, because it adds an additional 4 levels that all got, like, incorporated into the story mode.
Okay.
So that's a really interesting version, Tony Hawk's Underground 2 Remix. Honestly, kind of a shame that was just stuck on PSP forever. It takes an obvious and noticeable graphical hit, but it still plays great. It's a very impressive port, given what they were working with. And Shaba Games would close their doors after making a very strange Spider-Man game for the Xbox 360 called Spider-Man Web of Shadows. Which was a very 2009 video game, in that it was a Spider-Man game with a moral choice system. with the justification for why you would be playing an evil Spider-Man being that you are back under the influence of the black suit, and that the evil choices are representations of the black suit exerting more control over Peter's brain.
It's a good idea.
Which is why it is the only Spider-Man game ever released where one of the multiple possible endings is Spider-Man and Black Cat as evil half-symbiote monarchs of Manhattan Island.
Okay.
Extremely strange game. I love it. It's weird. It's obviously incomplete. It's got a lot of Luke Cage and Moon Knight in it.
Appreciate that.
There is a boss fight with Wolverine where Wolverine doesn't trust Peter because of the news about the black suit, and I think he thinks you might be a clone or something, because, like, there are QuickTime events where he is asking you Spider-Man trivia, like, trying to determine whether you're the real Peter Parker.
Oh.
And if you... there's one of them that... this is one of the funniest jokes I've ever seen as a meta joke in a video game. One of the questions you get asked is... I forget what the exact question is, but the point is, it's a really obscure question, especially for the time. And if you get it wrong, Peter quips back, "Come on, that's not even on my Wikipedia page." And
wow.
At the time, it absolutely wasn't. It was up to after that game came out, fairly shortly afterwards, it was updated to add that piece of information. But at the time of the game's release, that was not on his Wikipedia page.
What was it?
I'll have to look it up later. I'll find it for you. But yeah, Web of Shadows is a really interesting game, in part because it did not have to tie into any particular movie. It was just an original story. Like, heroic red suit, good ending where you, like, reconcile with Mary Jane. Evil black suit, bad ending where you're a weird space monster and you're, like, you start a romance with Black Cat. It's a really strange video game. That was made by Shaba Games. Again, a very talented studio that, like, Activision just sort of pissed away and treated like shit. Sorry, I just wanted to stump for that because it's a really strange little game. My iMac came with the Apple Pro mouse, but I found a Puck mouse and tried to use it. It was terrible. What was the worst mouse you have ever used in your life? It's probably the puck mouse.
Which one was the puck mouse?
The circular one.
Oh, yeah, that was a piece of shit. I'm gonna go with that one, too.
Like, it's just a tremendously ill-advised device.
I don't know. I just remember several of those old beige mice with the ball in it, and they were awful.
The track ball.
Yeah, and then they come out
with... to clean hair and shit out of them, but they were fine. They were better than the puck.
I should point out, the puck was also a trackball.
The laser mice were fun.
I like the tactile fun of occasionally removing the trackball so that I can clean it. Mm. Feels soothing.
I thought it was a bouncy ball. It did not bounce.
Since this is relevant, people have found patents that seem to imply that the rumor that the Switch 2 Joy-Cons can act as optical mice is probably true.
That's cool. Does that mean my Switch 2 will be able to run Linux and act like a mini laptop?
What a dreadful idea.
You can already do that on Steam Deck.
And you can the trackpads do not feel good.
But you can sync up a portable Bluetooth mouse.
That is true, you can do that.
And you can get a
I can't attach it to the Steam Deck. My Mac already has a RAM upgrade, so I only have to add an SSD to it. When was the first time you had an SSD in your PC or console? I remember when the PS4 originally came out and a 1 TB SSD was like $500. Like I would have had a laptop that had an SSD in it like 10 years ago at this point.
Now in 2020, I installed my first SSD when I built a new computer.
It's nice the first time because it's like, restarting the computer doesn't have to take 2 minutes.
Nope.
Hmm?
Yeah, but now...
I think I considered putting one in my PS3, but I never did.
She did.
I can tell, because like when I turn that PS3 on, you can tell. You can hear it.
But I have an M.2 Gen 3 SSD, and now I don't want to put anything on my old SATA SSD. Yeah, no, I never put an SSD in a PS3 or PS4 now. That always seemed kind of pointless.
I think I put one in my PS4.
But the PS5, you know, that's what it has by default, and then the extra M.2 slot requires a Gen 4. And those are coming down. I got a 1 TB for like 90. Of course, it's full, but now a 2 TB is more reasonably priced. I guess the PS5 Pro does have a 2 TB SSD built in.
Oh boy, $700.
Serious, ugh. Yep.
I finally tried Tron 2.0. Please address it by its full title, Tron 2.0 Killer App.
Oh, that's clever.
On Mac, it was pretty good, but you gotta ask why something like Tron had a game in the 2000s of all things. Disney back in those days would only make sequels to their biggest successes. The thing is that Tron was beloved by nerds. And the people buying shooters on the PC in 2002 were nerds.
Tron was awesome. I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm just saying, like, it was a financial failure. It's really the broader point that's being made.
Yeah. What? When did that? When did Tron Legacy come out?
About 2010.
Okay. Well, that was a cool movie too. That had a really good soundtrack.
Yeah. It's got style. It randomly appeared in Kingdom Hearts Dream Draft. Was an extremely strange and interesting poll. I would say like Tron is one of those things where I think the developer/publisher sought the license as opposed to Disney seeking out partners to work with them on it. And you know, they were like, there were nascent plans for some sort of Tron reboot or sequel, because like it did have a cult following and they wanted to see if they could expand that, and eventually those would turn into Tron Legacy. But you know, certainly at the time, I think some of it was also just, again, the developers slash publisher like sought out the license because there was a known cult following among the kind of person who would buy a PC game in 2002. That would be my best guess as to why that happened. A left field question. How do you feel about sports fans who care too much about stats? There is no true single way to enjoy a sport, and it's good to know things like the ERA ratio, but man, some people really only see the stats. I mean, like, stats are an easy shorthand, and nerds love stats, which is why a lot of nerds come to sports by stats.
That's why nerds like baseball.
But I've always, you know, I'm sure I've stumped for John Boyce videos from Secret Base plenty of times on this podcast, but I'll do it again because he does a good job of like finding stats as an excuse to tell a story. Like, you look at the stats and it's like, why did this happen? Like, what is the strange story that caused this to be the case? And so if you've never watched his like 3.5 hour history of the Seattle Mariners or 3 hour history of the Atlanta Falcons, or is like, you know, these history of the Minnesota Vikings, like just these really long histories that go into like the stats as an excuse to tell stories about why these teams are special, even though all of them are at best ever the crownless kings, and at worst often absolutely terrible from season to season. Those are great videos. He's got like, just in general, like Secret Base as a whole is great if you just enjoy sports for the reasons of the kind of person, the kind of people that it takes to make a mark on these, the kind of weird people that do these things, who become these statistical outliers, who become, or even people who don't. Like, the kind of person that it takes to be in sports at all. So, genuinely a lot of great stuff. Chart Party, pretty good. Like, all those, there's, if you're more into simulated sports, there's the Fumble Dimension, which is a series of simulating, doing truly detestable things to video game sports simulations to see what becomes of them. You can basically just start with the first one where they decide to try to create the worst, to destroy the NBA by creating and forcing the game to simulate the worst draft class ever over and over and over until there are no good players left. down to the point where, like, because of the way they did it, I think all of them started with like a some extremely strange injury, like a sprained elbow. God. But it was all like the shortest players that they could produce with the worst possible stats in literally everything. But yeah, those are fun. Like, just if you don't like sports, or you don't think you like sports, but you do like weird, the weird history that comes with people trying to be the best at something very specific. Generally, videos from Secret Base are very good. I recommend them. How many times has Donkey Kong Country returns? I suppose, yeah, Joe kindly answers correctly, 3.
There was Wii, there was 3DS, and now Switch.
There is Switch.
And if you wanted to count Tropical Freeze, then it would be 5, because you had Wii U and then Switch, but that doesn't have returns in the title.
Yeah, that was merely it returning, it did not returns. I need to get to bed relatively early, so Joe, if you want to tell us what you've been playing and then tell us where we can find you.
Oh, sure, I can do all that. All right, so what have I been playing? Well, I mentioned this already probably, but I did pick up the Diablo 4 expansion at a discount and made a new seasonal character, the Spiritborn class, and got through that, the new story content for the expansion. And it's fine, whatever. I mean, the whole point of Diablo is you kill demons, you get loot. But I also recorded the full playthrough. It's five parts long. It took about 8 hours. And so that's up on YouTube, all five parts of that. And then after that, just working on seasonal content, and the Spiritborn class is actually kind of fun because his whole thing is he gets powers from different spirit animals. And at first I was just focusing on the Jaguar and Eagle skills, which are, you know, fire and electricity is what they end up being. And the thing is, I'm kind of afraid of centipedes.
And
the spirit born, all of his poison skills come from his centipede spirit animal. And so at first I didn't want to play it, but then I was like, you know, I really want to try like a fun poison build. So I had to overcome that phobia to do a really fun poison build. And I just, I don't know, like I unlock torment difficulty and I'm just like ripping through everything that comes after me. And my ultimate ability is he summons a giant centipede that spits poison everywhere, and it's creepy, but it's effective. So I'm actually having fun with that, with the new class and stuff. And still playing Final Fantasy XIV, still slowly getting through the Stormborn content. Stormborn or Storm... whatever.
Stormwind?
Storm whatever. Wind. Stormblood, Storm...
Why am I the one that knows this?
What the hell is it called?
Stormblood. It's Stormblood.
Oh, Stormblood. Stormborn, Storm... blah. Anyway, Stormblood. So, still slowly working on that expansion, and got to some new regions that are very interesting. So I'm like level 65 with the Bard class and 64 with Summoner Scholar. And you go to this new region where, you know, the Empire, of course, is occupying it, and you're trying to help the resistance. And you go to the city that looks just like, you know, an old Japanese city. It's really, really fun to explore. There's some interesting quests there. There's this tiny little catfish man who agrees to help you but then betrays you to the Empire, and you get ambushed, and then your friend Liss, that's the blonde girl, she just punts him like a football, basically, and it's hilarious. And then I decided to go back and level up the ninja class, and it's cool because the whole ninja storyline actually ties into the new area that I'm in, because it turns out this region is where all of the ninjas and samurai come from. So leveling up the ninja to 52 and doing all of those quests to get abilities, and it's actually a neat little quest line there. And then when you're playing the ninja, you get these mudra things, and what you do is if you do them in a certain order, then you get different abilities and stuff. So for instance, you depending on which ones you pick, what order you do them in, you get either a lightning attack, an ice attack, or an area of effect fire attack. But if you accidentally hit the same one twice, you get this little bunny that pops up above your head for a few seconds, basically just to let people know that you're a moron. You know.
I do like letting people know I'm dumb.
So
I think that helps me.
So yeah, if you hit the wrong buttons, you get a little bunny, and that's funny. So yeah, so playing that. And then I jumped into Street Fighter 6 because Mai is best girl, and she's in Street Fighter now.
Oh, that's
and out. Of course, Chun-Li and Ken are going to be in the new Mark of the Wolves game. But I jumped into World Tour mode and found her, did her whole little quest line, got her to teach me her style, and then kept giving her gifts until I unlocked her alternate costume. So that was a fun little thing to do for, I don't know, 2 hours or so. That's what's great. Every time Street Fighter adds a new DLC character, you can go into World Tour and find them and do some quests, and it's fun.
Yeah, you get to learn about them.
And I did some of her combo trials, and there's some interesting stuff you can do with her that you could not do in King of Fighters. So she plays a little differently, as expected, but familiar enough. You know, she throws her fan, she does her, you know, spinning fire attack, she does her diving thing. So, you know, she's interesting. Really one of my favorite fighting game characters, really. She's nice. And, but Andy is there. She finds Andy, and he's hanging out in her new little area where you visit her. Mm-hmm. So, Andy's there.
Probably that's why she went to Metro City in the first place.
Yes. Yeah, well, because, you know, she knew Terry was there, and she's like, Terry must know where Andy is. They're brothers. Right. But then there's other King of Fighters characters, though, like Blue Mary is in there, and then you can actually learn some of their moves. So I learned one of Blue Mary's moves and one of Andy Bogard's moves.
That's wild. They're getting ready for Capcom versus SNK3. It's not.
Yes, gimme.
Yeah. I mean, I'm still hoping that maybe it's wishful thinking at this point, but what if a Darkstalkers character made it into Street Fighter 6? You know, like Morgan.
I kind of doubt it.
I doubt it, but I'd be happy. So, playing that. And then I was playing Civilization 7 because I pre-ordered the deluxe edition that lets you play early and comes with some DLC stuff that I know I'm going to end up buying anyways.
How much does that cost you?
$100.
Holy fuck.
The deluxe edition, yeah. Standard is 70, so you pay an extra $30 and you get... Yeah, well, then you get some DLC packs, and then you get to play early, and some other cosmetic items, and yeah, it's neat. Like, well, you get, like, you can get alternate leader personas, so it's the same person, but they look different, and they have slightly different abilities and stuff. So it's fine. It feels a little bit bare bones, but it's no different than 5 and 6 were at launch. You know, I'm remembering playing 6 at launch, and they've added so much stuff to that game over the years. So I'm sure they'll get there eventually. So just tried out a couple of scenarios. I haven't completed a scenario yet. I'm still learning the new mechanics, and it's a little different, but not in a bad way. And so I'm playing it on Steam, and first off, it has full controller support, so playing 7 on PC is just like playing 6 on console, you know, so it sees the controller, the buttons are mapped just fine. I've seen so many negative Steam reviews complaining about the UI. I don't know what the hell they're talking about. It's fine. Maybe these are people who, maybe they only played 6 on PC and they just want to use a mouse, because it does seem like they were trying to create a comparable experience across all platforms, and they wanted it to work on Steam Deck, which it does. So even though I had no intention of playing on Steam Deck, I actually was like, let's just try it. And it's like, oh, this is great. It's actually a great game to play on Steam Deck.
It seems like it would be.
Yeah, they did a good job of mapping the controller buttons. And the performance is fine. So graphics are slightly better than 6, and performance is fine. At 4K, you don't need a top-of-the-line system for it at all. There's no ray tracing. And no DLSS, but it does support FSR3, which is good. So it boosts your frame rate a little bit without hurting the visuals. Just a lot of new stuff that I'm still trying to wrap my head around. So I haven't done a full scenario. I have 3 different ones that I was just trying out, you know, with different leaders and different settings. And there's a lot of new stuff, and a lot of the new mechanics were inspired by some of the DLC stuff that was added later to 6. So it's interesting how they've incorporated that and refined it a little bit. So there's no builders. You don't need them anymore. What happens is you found your city and you start with one population, right? So you, the game will tell you, okay, which tile do you want this citizen to work on? So you pick a tile, and they build automatically build some, you know, thing on it. So it'll tell you what you're going to get, you know. So certain tiles, you'll get a farm, and that gets you an extra food. Certain tiles, you get a mine that gets you extra production. But that now, you don't buy new tiles with money, and it's not like it just automatically, you know, picks a random tile to add after X number of turns or whatever. No, it's so when you get, when population goes up, you get a new citizen, you pick which tile you want them to work on, it tells you what yields you get, and then it annexes adjacent tiles as long as it's not owned by another player. So that's how you grow your borders and work your tiles, and you don't have to keep getting builders or workers, and it's like, oh, that's really neat, actually. Six had you placing districts in different tiles, and then you had buildings within those districts, and you had buildings within the city center. Now you don't have districts, but each building takes up a tile now. So like the monument takes up a tile, the granary takes up a tile, but they also give you more tiles and you get them at a faster rate, and it feels good, you know. It's different, but it feels good. And you know, of course, wonders still take up their own tile and they give you benefits, and there's still adjacency bonuses and all that. So there's neat stuff. And then when you get a second settlement, it starts out as a town, not a city. And the way the town works is that whatever production it would give you, like you can't produce anything, but whatever production it generates is automatically converted to gold. So you can spend it on anything, and then you can buy buildings and units within that town. And then eventually, if you save up enough money, you can convert it to a city, but there's pros and cons to doing that. And each town can get a specialization. So it's like, oh, that's neat. And like, just a lot of interesting new twists. And like, there's no barbarians, but they've kind of combined, like, because you've got your city states still, but they kind of combine elements of the kind of barbarian clans expansion thing from six. So like, you'll find a settlement and you can attack them and just disperse it and get money just like you would with a barbarian outpost, or you can spend the influence points that you accrue every turn and you can make them friendly and eventually turn them into a full city state, and you become the suzerain and you can levy the military. So it's like, oh, that's a cool way of doing it. So there's just more of a focus on the city building and on diplomacy and less so on exploration and combat, from what I can gather. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. You've got a whole new diplomacy system where you get influence points that you spend, like basically it'll tell you, you spend 20 points and you get open borders, that sort of thing. You know, which is similar to kind of the whole World Congress system that they added towards the end of Civ 6's life cycle. So that's what I mean. It's like you can see how they've incorporated stuff from 6 and done new things. And like, you pick a leader, but then you pick the civilization that you want, and then you switch when you get to future ages. So it's like, I picked Ben Franklin, but I was Greece, which I thought was neat, you know. And then when you get to the second age, you can switch to something else. I forget what I picked for that. But it's kind of fun. And then they added Harriet Tubman as a leader, which I think is cool, because, you know, the Underground Railroad and, you know, helping slaves escape to the North and all that. And of course, you know, you've got these negative reviews on Steam where they can't help themselves but be like, oh, Harriet Tubman. It's like, oh, shut up. And one of the civilizations is the Mississippian, which incorporates, like, you know, the Native American cultures from that region at, you know, prior to the, you know, the formation of the United States. So, cool. So it's just interesting to see all these different leaders and these different civilizations. And I wish that there were more, but we know that they're going to add more, so it's fine. A lot of people are complaining there aren't that many choices. It's like, well, you got Ben Franklin, you got Himiko. Were
there when 6 came out?
No, exactly. 6 had, what, like 10 people to start with, right? So you get Ben Franklin, you get Himiko, You get Machiavelli. You get Charlemagne. You know, Catherine the Great. You get a lot of cool people. So I don't know. I like it so far. I think I've played 3 or 4 hours of it so far. So I have a positive first impression, although I do understand some of the complaints that people have, and there are some things that, again, that I'm not quite understanding yet, but I just have to play it more. Like, there's times where I'm like losing battles and I don't understand why the enemy has like more combat power than I do. Or I was laying siege to a city and then I had 3 different units that died trying to take it when it only had a sliver of health left. I'm like, what the fuck is going on? So just little things here and there that I just have to pay more attention and, you know, like the combat modifiers and whatnot. And here's the thing too, like as war weariness increases, your units actually get lower combat power as a result. So the longer a war goes on, the weaker you get, which is kind of annoying, but you can see how they're trying to discourage you from just doing domination in every single, you know, scenario. So, yeah. But that's what I've been playing. And you can still check me out on YouTube/SmokinJoeGamer. And I have, yeah, so I got those Diablo 4 videos that I talked about, and I'm planning on doing some videos for Civilization 7. Like, once I really learn the ropes, I'd like to do some videos on that, and then do some FF14 live streams, maybe. I had an idea to do Final Fantasy February. I haven't started yet, but I got it a discount on 10 and 12, which I've never played before, so I'm looking forward to that. And yeah, just try to do some videos on Final Fantasy games this month, and maybe get back into some Twitch streaming. So we'll see. So it's also twitch.tv/SmokinJoeGamer. I might, you know, start doing that again.
Yay!
Hooray!
Yeah. And follow me on Blue Sky.
Yeah. You can follow us all on Blue Sky. I don't post. I mostly just jump in to post things about whatever RPG I'm playing, but I'm there sometimes.
Nobody liked my dad joke the other day.
That's,
I said, well, I mentioned that I kind of have seasonal affective disorder. Like, I get sad in the winter, huh? Mm. And then I said, why do bears hibernate? Because winter is unbearable.
Oh, I missed that one. I would have gotten a chuckle out of that, damn it.
Yeah.
You probably would have posted a Teddy GIF in response.
Yeah, that's what I was expecting, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I've been on social media less for my health.
Yeah, right. No, I hear you. I hear you.
But, yeah. Well, I needed to briefly step out to use the restroom. Have we plugged Gaijin?
Not yet.
Then I shall do the honors. As ever, one of the things we like to make sure to do is to support our local indie author. Gaijin was not able to be here this week, but that doesn't mean that you still can't get access to the many works of fiction he has compiled for your perusing pleasure on Amazon via Kindle or Kindle Unlimited or Dead Tree format, if you're old school like that. Princesses of the Pizza Parlor, if you enjoy the notion of an of actual play podcast in the context of, you know, just making of just chronicling the tabletop games of a group of characters, but with the additional crafted nature of an authored narrative, that should be right up your alley, especially for you or the young girls in your lives. That would be, again, Princesses of the Pizza Parlor. There's like, how many short stories at this point? Like 12 parts at this point?
Something like that.
Yeah, close to 12 parts, and then the paralogue of unusual length. But yeah, so that's plenty to keep you occupied if that's your sort of thing. There's also Tanuki at the Teapot, which is a compilation of retellings of various Japanese folktales, some of which have very little footprint in English. So if you're interested in that sort of thing, that is also available, again, via Kindle, Kindle Unlimited, or print on demand. These are, no matter when you get these, they will always be, you know, very competitively priced, I'll put it that way. So give them a look. If you're looking for them, be looking for Michael Yarimizu, Y-A-R-I-M-I-Z-U, because Michael Baker is basically an ungoogleable thing and was even before Google became useless. So, yeah, give those a look. Support your local indie author. But yeah, as for us, thanks once again to Fireminer for providing our questions this week. We ran a little short this week. We'll be diving back into the question mines more thoroughly next week, hopefully. But for now, you can ask us questions if you catch us when we stream, which is at 9 p.m. typically at 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern on Thursdays. That will stream to twitch.tv/rpgamer and twitch.tv/askwheels. We also have our sister show Shenanigans, where we just sort of do whatever the hell we feel like. That is at 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern, but only on twitch.tv/askwheels, yes. Because oftentimes we are not playing RPGs. Otherwise, you can also ask us questions in the RP Gamer Discord by going to rpgamer.com and clicking the community tab. You can find an invite there. If you put a question in the podcast section, unless it's specifically something that is very much addressed to a specific RPG cast member, we will probably answer it. And even if it's directed at another podcast, if it's an interesting enough question, we'll answer it anyway. Sure. But otherwise, you can also ask this question in the comment section under this very episode on rpgamer.com. So, yeah. Otherwise, I think that about does it for us. So see you, Space Cowboys.
See you.
See ya.